fade down Rita Donte a little bit. She's a Cuban singer. The new album out called Ritual. This is obviously the song Havana. I'll let you know that this is Jeff Spitzer-Resnick, host of Hejira World Music Radio Show, every Thursday morning from 9 a.m. till noon, 12:01. To be precise, when the BBC News will be coming on next, followed by a public affair hosted by Alan Ruff. And that will be with the poet Martin Espada from his new collection, Jailbreak of Sparrows, here on WORT 89.9 FM.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Stock markets worldwide have fallen sharply in response to Donald Trump's announcement of sweeping global trade tariffs. By one estimate, more than $1.5 trillion was wiped off the value of shares on Wall Street at the start of trading on Thursday. Investors fear the tariffs will hit growth and drive up inflation worldwide. The Nobel Prize winner for economics, Paul Krugman, gave the BBC his reaction to the announcement.
I'm kind of, in a way, glad to be alive as an international trade economist at this moment, because what the hell? And it's doing it all in one jump. This is the biggest trade shock in the history of the world. It's an incredible, massive break with 90 years of U.S. trade policy.
The leaders of France and Canada are among those to have condemned Mr. Trump's policy on tariffs. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney announced retaliation for American tariffs on cars. The French President Emmanuel Macron has said tariffs would have a massive impact on Europe's economy, but that Americans would also end up poorer.
La décision qui a été annoncée cette nuit est une décision brutale et infondée.
The decision that was announced last night was brutal and unfounded. Unfounded because you don't correct trade imbalances by imposing tariffs. Economic theory shows the opposite, especially when the imbalances do not take into account digital services, to name just one. Basically, this decision will affect all sectors of our economies.
Gaza's civil defense agency says at least 29 people have been killed in an Israeli airstrike on a school, which was being used as a refugee shelter. Children are reported to be among more than 100 Palestinians wounded. Israel's military says it struck a Hamas command and control center. From Jerusalem, Dan Johnson.
A statement from Israel Defense Forces says it targeted a site being used by Hamas militants to launch attacks on its soldiers. But Gaza's civil defense agency says a school sheltering displaced Palestinians was hit in Tufa, northeast of Gaza City. Video from a nearby hospital shows children being rushed in cars and trucks with very serious injuries. More than 100 people are reported wounded, and the number of dead keeps increasing. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says more than 100 people have been killed in the last 24 hours after Israel expanded its military operation in the north of the territory.
Israel's defense minister has said he doesn't consider a violent attack on a Palestinian village by Israeli settlers this week to be a form of terrorism. Israel Katz was speaking after the assault on Douma by 50 settlers who set homes ablaze and attacked residents. He said although all lawbreakers should be prosecuted, he thought the use of administrative detention was not appropriate. BBC News. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio has told NATO countries he wants them to commit to spending 5% of their income on defence during a summit currently being held in Brussels. Mr. Rubio sought to reassure member states that the US was not turning away from the alliance. Myanmar's military leader is attending a regional summit in Bangkok after the number of people known to have died in last week's earthquake passed 3,000. Critics say he should have stayed at home to help oversee relief efforts. Nick Beek reports.
Today, the head of the junta, Senior General Min Aung Hlaing, flew to Bangkok for a regional economic summit. He's been largely ostracized from the global stage, relying on support from Russia and China, so his presence today marks a rehabilitation of sorts. But the dire domestic reality to which he'll return will shape his immediate fate. There's now a short-term ceasefire in Myanmar, but the Burmese people often see their fortunes as divine judgment on the deeds of their leaders. Rising anger, despair, and disease would represent a new and dangerous threat to the junta.
Pakistan is reported to have resumed the expulsion of Afghan nationals. Migrants had been given a deadline of the end of March to leave voluntarily. The repatriations are said to focus on Islamabad and Rawalpindi. Many of those affected have lived in Pakistan for years. There are signs of a widening rift in South Africa's fragile governing coalition as the Democratic Alliance Party has gone to court to challenge the new budget following weeks of disagreement. The alliance is opposed to a tax increase. On Wednesday, the biggest party, the African National Congress, managed to get the budget narrowly passed in the National Assembly. BBC News.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is going on now, all over Madison until April 10th. There are over 170 films of all shapes and sizes for you to choose from. This includes some of the best cinema from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. Choose from comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. You can catch these films at the Bartell Theater, the Barrymore Theater, and four venues on the UW campus. The last 4 days of the festival will take place at Flick's Brewhouse, located at the Easttown Mall. A guide to all the films and where they will be shown is available in the March issue of the Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The Wisconsin Film Festival is happening now through April 10th on a screen near you, helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon and welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Listen to the words of the famed writer Joyce Carol Oates, her description of our guest today, Martine Espada. Espada, she tells us, is a captivating storyteller and memoirist. His great subject is the drama of the Puerto Rican diaspora. His method is meticulously crafted portraiture of lives that intertwine with history, among them his own, radiantly defiant and fearless. Espada is one of our most important contemporary poets. An acclaimed people's voice, former Madisonian and Wartista, Espada, referred to by some as the Pablo Neruda of North America, has published more than 20 books as a poet, editor, essayist, and translator. They include the collection Floaters, which was the winner of the National Book Award, Vivas to Those Who Have Failed, and The Republic of Poetry, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His many honors include the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, the Shelley Memorial Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. We're fortunate to have Martine with us today since Monday marked the formal release of his latest poetry compilation, Jailbreak of Sparrows, from which he'll be reading. While we have him with us today, my hope as well is to hear his take on the current moment, especially of late, the moves afoot from on high to silence and erase history and popular memory, an exorcism of critical thinking, the imposition of a mandatory national narrative and unity of thought in our schools, universities, and in other institutions. Martine Espada, welcome, my old friend. Welcome back to WORT's A Public Affair.
Thank you, Alan. It's good to be back.
Clearly, as Martin has evidenced through the number of times he appears throughout the body of your published volumes, your father, the late Frank Espada, played a significant role in the development of your social and political consciousness. Tell us about him. Tell us about Frank Espada.
My father, Francisco Luis Espada, Frank Espada, was born in the mountain town of Utuado, Puerto Rico, in 1930. Came to this country and settled in New York with his family as a child, and went on to become a community organizer, a civil rights activist, a documentary photographer. a leader, some would say the leader, of the Puerto Rican community in New York and beyond in the 1960s and early 1970s. He was also a natural teacher, as you might imagine, given the combination of those qualities. And I was there to be taught.
Read to us the brief poem that explains so much, I believe. Look at this.
Look at this. My father spoke. Look at this, he said to me. We were walking through an alley from somewhere to somewhere else in Brooklyn. In front of us, a man with white hair and white beard reached into a dumpster, plucked out a bag of potato chips, stuffed his arm up to the elbow in the bag, let it flutter to the pavement at his feet, and shuffled ahead. Look at this, my father said again. Sometimes he would repeat himself. He walked up behind the white-haired man, called, "Good morning, sir." So the other man wheeled around to see us, shook his hand, and left a $20 bill in the handshake, all without slowing down. We never spoke of it again. The day we left Brooklyn, he drove away so fast he left a stack of his 78s in the closet of the apartment in the projects. Look at this, was all he said, and all he had to say. Look.
That looking, the eye of a socially conscious photographer, documentarian, political activist, you've learned to look, you learned to see.
Yes, you learn to look, you learn to see. And of course, it's important to point out that this was the eye of an activist, but also the eye of an artist. And so this is the beginning of that combination between craft and commitment. Look.
You're listening to Martin Espada as we look at some of his work today, visual portraits, verbal portraits. We'll be opening up the phone lines at half past the hour at 608-256-2001. If you wish to join us today with a question, a comment, an observation with Martin Espada, again, 608-256-2001. Martin, again, as evidenced by the subjects of your work, your years spent in Madison in the late 70s had a significant impact on your future. One of the influences was your teachers at the UW, especially the historians. Talk about that for a moment, especially since, as I mentioned in the intro, people's history, popular history, counter-narrative history is increasingly under attack today.
I wandered through my own history. I got to Madison in 1977, went to school for one semester, dropped out, worked, went back to school, dropped out again. I think at one point I was an eighth semester sophomore, but I kept going. And in the process, had the opportunity to meet and learn from some extraordinary teachers. One of those teachers, perhaps most important to me, was Professor Steve Stern in the history department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I ultimately ended up with a BA in history, and he had everything to do with that. But he was much more than a teacher of history. Steve taught me how to think, critically, how to think empathetically. These were lessons I could take far beyond the classroom, obviously. And so I ultimately stayed in touch with Steve over the years, on and off, on and off. And more recently, I had the opportunity to write a poem for Steve. I, of course, also knew and had the experience of learning informally from his wife, Florencia Mayon, who, like Steve, is a historian and an author. I found out that Florencia was in memory hospice. And so I talked to Steve on the phone, and he said, "There is something you could do for me. Once in a while, I like to be able to talk to you and listen to you read poetry. Just read me poetry. It would be helpful to me." I decided to take it one step further. I wrote a poem for Steve about Steve and Florencia at this moment in their lives, based on what he had told me was going on, and based also on a conversation I had with Rebecca Kemble of the Threshold Singers in Madison. And so I called Steve back one night and I said, "I have a poem to read to you. And this is the poem. It's called Florencia Again and Again for Steve Stern. The singers sang to Florencia Mayon today. The Threshold Singers stood at the bedside in memory hospice and sang as the poster of Frida Kahlo looked on, as Florencia looked on. The only word she spoke was no, the only word still left on her tongue as she colored in her coloring book. The chorus sang as you walked into the room and Florencia's eyes brimmed with the sight of you, husband, compañero. You slid behind her, arms looped around her neck, and she leaned back, lips sprouting for a kiss on the mouth once, then again. Let's sing to the singers, you said. You queued up the song on your cell. You sang, gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto. Thanks to life that has given me so much. Florencia sang in Spanish was Florencia again, the song drifting from a window in the girlhood Santiago of her head. She became the writer of history she could no longer read, the teacher of students who would remember what she could not remember, Florencia again. When life and the song gave her the abecedario, she sang the word for alphabet from a spring so deep in the cavern of her brain, no neurologist could ever find it, Florencia again. When life and the song gave her la marcha de mis pies cansados, she sang about the march of my tired feet, loud enough to startle the pack of nurses in the hallway, the march with you, her compañero, your tired feet trying to keep up with her, the march against the dictator in her Chile, all the songs the crowd would sing, Florencia again. How do you kill an idea? Florencia said to me when I asked why so many had to die in Chile at an age when I still had to ask. Six words I will carry like tiny shells from Chile as long as I remember what I remember, Florencia again. Gracias. You sang with Florencia at the bedside to the singers at Memory Hospice. You handed them the sheets with the printed lyrics of the song. Next time, when you come, you can sing it to her, you said, Florencia again. My teacher, tomorrow you will turn the knob all hands dread. as if the steel would liquefy their fingers. Walk through the door once more and sing. And so Florencia will become Florencia again and again.
Florencia Marlon. Presente. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
Martin Espada, the body of your work is loaded with political pieces, commentaries, if you will, on the contemporary world and its connection, its inextricable linkages to the past. A great deal of past being erased, as I mentioned in the intro. Give us, I'd like to do a couple of these. I'd like for you to do a couple of these. Talk about the snake.
It comes as a bit of a shock to realize that one of the presidential candidates campaigned with a poem in the last election cycle, that it wasn't a Democrat. Now, it wasn't actually a poem either. At his Save America rallies, Donald Trump would read what he in fact called a poem, but was in actuality the lyrics of a song. That song is called The Snake. The Snake is a song written and performed by jazz singer Oscar Brown Jr. back in 1963. I don't know how Trump got hold of these lyrics, but he did. The lyrics written by Oscar Brown Jr. were in turn based on one of Aesop's fables, The Farmer and the Viper. It should be familiar to people who read or hear this poem. Of course, Trump wasn't merely entertaining his acolytes. He had a lesson to teach. He used the, quote, poem as a parable to demonize immigrants. Now, at the same time this was going on, and he was performing this, quote, poem for his adoring masses at the Save America rallies, there was a Department of Labor investigation that revealed a widespread use of underage immigrant labor on the cleaning crews of slaughterhouses. This I then ended up juxtaposing with the Save America rallies and the snake. So it all comes together in the following poem. The Snake. At the Save America rallies, after the damnation of the criminal aliens breaking across our borders and 1,900% more murders, he would ask the crowds if he could read a poem. This has to do with immigration, he'd say. The crowds would whoop and yip. He'd read The Snake, words stolen from a song from the hand of a dead black singer who could not snatch it back. A jazz fable spun on vinyl, spun first by the fabulist of Greece centuries before Christ. The crowds would listen to the poem. Bikers for Trump, cops for Trump, Uncle Sam in his beard, the Statue of Liberty in her crown, the millionaire who sells pillows on TV. They would testify in t-shirts that said, Jesus is my savior, Trump is my president. They would hoist the stars and bars or signs that rhymed Trump 24 or before. They would see the movie of the poem in their heads. The snake frozen on the road. The woman scooping him up tight to nurse him with milk and honey by the fire. The incandescence of his skin brought back to life. The woman's kiss and the viper's venomous bite. Her question, why? Then the words oozing from his tongue. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in. The crowd would howl at the moral, at the punchline, at the tender woman who would die of tenderness. Like a preacher spelling out the lesson of a parable, their president would repeat, immigration. As they slept, the bikers and the cops, Uncle Sam and the Statue of Liberty, the millionaire on his magic pillow, adolescents from Guatemala scalded the killing floors at the slaughterhouse in Grand Island, Nebraska, their hoses like snakes spewing rivers that bubbled in the steam. Around them, the blades of skull splitters and bone saws waited for their fingers to slip, fangs lurking in the murk of early morning, in the days behind the goggles on the faces of adolescents from Guatemala, sleeping the next day at Walnut Middle School, shaken awake by teachers who spotted the acid burns on their hands.
Martinez Spada, reading from selections from his recently released book, the title of which just drops out of my mind.
Jailbreak of Sparrows.
Yes, thank you. Jailbreak of Sparrows. It reminds me, if we have time, I'll go into a story that Harvey Goldberg used to relate. Actually, a writing of Rosa Luxemburg's about a sparrow outside her jail cell and one of her imprisonments by the rightists. 608-256-2001. Again, if you want to join in this conversation with Martinez Spada, 608-256-2001. The lines will open a little early today. Give us a call if you want to if you have a comment, an observation, a point to make. 608-256-2001. Iguanas skitter through the cemetery. There's a poem of history, of memory, and forgetting, of the legacies of colonialism, some grand metaphor running through it. Talk about that, Martin.
Well, I couldn't put it better myself, as they say, because this is a poem about memory and forgetting. It is a poem about colonialism and resistance to colonialism. There is indeed the central metaphor of the iguana. So a couple years ago, I was on the island and noticed, in fact, that there was an infestation of iguanas. They were absolutely everywhere. And that began to especially prey on my mind when I paid a visit to a cemetery in Viejo San Juan. And this is quite a famous cemetery because, among other things, it houses, first of all, the poet José de Diego, who was a leader of the independence movement in the early 20th century, and who wrote anti-imperialist poems, died young. He's there. And he's not the only noteworthy resident of that cemetery. Pedro Albizu Campos is there. Pedro Albizu Campos, or Albizu for short, was the foremost leader of the independence movement in Puerto Rico in the 20th century. he was the head of the Nationalist Party. He spent many years in prison as a result. This was a kind of pilgrimage, but it was impossible not to notice the iguanas everywhere we looked. It was also impossible not to see the new forms of colonialism alongside the old. The traditional gunboat diplomacy is now given way to the gunboat diplomacy of the almighty dollar. You may be aware, your listeners may be aware of the stranglehold of something called the Fiscal Control Board in Puerto Rico, the ways in which the Spanish-American War never ended. So I ended up writing this poem. It is the last poem of the book, and it is called The Iguana Skitter Through the Cemetery by the Sea. Viejo San Juan, Puerto Rico. The iguana slither from the branches of trees splintered by the hurricanes. The iguanas crawl from the cracks in the ground split by the earthquakes. The iguanas rise from brown flood waters that carry bridges to their doom. The iguanas multiply through the night of blackouts in hospitals and morgues. The iguanas burrow beneath roads to bury their eggs in the lungs of cities. The iguanas slap their clawed feet as they churn the earth for the farmer's field. Iguanas rip the rough skin of mango. Iguanas rip banana. Iguanas rip papaya. The iguanas skitter through the cemetery by the sea, tails snapping when they disappear between the crosses, sunning themselves on the walls, hiding in the crevices of crypts where families still cling to each other beneath the weathered stone. The iguanas stare stupefied at the bust of a mustachioed poet who died after the bacteria feasted on his heart. The iguanas knew nothing of José de Diego, his songs of the guaraguao and the pitirre, the hawk fleeing from the 2-ounce kingbird, the slash of claws to save her young still blind in the nest. The poet's hawk is long and dark with imperial wings, the poet's kingbird and an arrow through the neck. An iguana warms his belly on the flat stone that says, Pedro Albizu Campos. The iguanas know nothing of Albizu, the lawyer and the cane cutter's strike, a crowd listening in the rain, cane stalks in their heads igniting like torches. The iguanas learn nothing from El Maestro, his staccato tongue on the radio splitting the ground under the boots of the military governor, collapsing the courthouses and flagpole of empire. The iguanas keep vigil at the tomb, burial stone white as the stone of seditious conspiracy that buried him, stone face of 30 years incarceration, subversive tongue gone to stone, after the stroke. The iguanas forget the thousands in black sweeping his coffin to the edge of the sea. The green of the iguanas in the cemetery is the green of soldiers in uniform. The green of the iguanas in the cemetery is the green of felt at the casinos. The green of the iguanas in the cemetery is the green of cash on cruise ships. The green of the iguanas in the cemetery is the green stacked in steel vaults. The green of the iguanas in the cemetery is the green of lawn after lawn hidden by gates. The green of mangoes in a bowl on every table of the absentee landlords. In the movies, on the drive-in screens and Saturday matinees of the Cold War, iguanas played the dinosaurs, horns glued to their snouts, frills pasted to their heads, thrashing in close-up struggle with other iguanas over the lost world. The dead eyes of the iguanas keeping vigil over the city of the dead will never see the asteroid of their extinction. The earth melting to suck their bones into whirlpools of mud, the waves sweeping them to sea, the flight of the poet's kingbird.
Once again, thank you, Martin Espada. You know, the first time I read the poem, that reference to like 1950s, early 60s science fiction movies with iguanas costumed, really, and made up to appear like monsters from wherever. Yeah, it transported me, as good poetry does. It transports.
It is funny how a detail such as that will sneak into a poem such as that. It's because I have the same memories.
We could probably name the station that played the movies in New York.
You go to the matinee and you see this
PIX,
crappy science fiction movies with these iguanas playing dinosaurs. You can still see them in cable late at night.
Jack, our engineer, tells me that we do have a caller with a question or a comment. Sergio, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Alan and Martin, thank you for the show. Martin, I'm digging your poetry. I wonder if you have any stories from back in the day, Rainbow Books, you and Alan, and maybe David El Boricua. Curious to know if there are some stories there. Thank you again for the show.
Well, thank you for that question. David Velasquez was a great friend of mine and a great friend of Alan's as well. I mentioned earlier that I've had many teachers. And, of course, not all the teachers were in the classroom. David Velasquez was one of my great teachers. He was a friend. He was a roommate. He was on WRT. He was one of the people who ran a show called Third World View on Sunday afternoons and turned that show over to me, which is how I ended up at WRT. David was an activist. He was a community organizer. He led by example. And he had story after story after story after story. And I sat at his knee and I listened to every single story. David died young. And I was gone from Madison by the time that happened. But Alan was there, you know, in David's final days. And Alan and I would talk to each other about what was going on. I did write a poem for David once called Prayer for Brother Burglar a long time ago. And I'm glad he had a chance to see it, to hear it. And on one of my visits back to Madison years later, Alan took me to David's grave. So thank you for mentioning David, our David.
David Presente. Thank you, Sergio, by the way. Martin, your newly released collection, Jailbreak of Sparrows, is dedicated to your wife, Lauren. Included as well in its pages are a number of love songs, clearly written to and for her. I'd like you to do maybe a couple of these. I very much appreciated. I liked very much Love Song of the Plátanos Maduros.
Yes. So it would be easy to assume that this is yet another one of my poetry collections with its collective fist in the air. That is to some extent true, but there are also a number of love poems. In the book, Love Songs, in this instance, refers to a series of such poems I wrote for Lauren. And they are all in persona. Every love song is in the voice of some weird, bizarre creature, or in this particular instance, in the voice of a dish of plátanos maduros, or fried, ripe plantains. So happens she loves them. So I thought, well, why don't I write a love sonnet in the voice of a plate of plátanos? This is the way I think. And here it is. Love song of the plátanos maduros. No, this is not a song for us. Ripe plantains sliced and fried in a pan. This is a song for you. A song in praise of your mouth and tongue. A song anticipating your anticipation of the first bite into our yellow hearts. A song to celebrate the delirium of the first kiss from you. No, this is not a song for us. The alchemy of the tough skin, green, then yellow, then black. This is a song for you. A song in praise of your nose breathing us in. A song for your eyes as they close to contemplate this offering more tempting than the wafer in church. No, this is not a song for us, flying from islands where the peasant stain of the plátano says, this is who I am. This is a song for you, a song in praise of your hands, lifting us slowly on the fork, as if to savor the delicacy of aristocrats, a song of delight in your delight. We live to be useful, and useful we will be, warming your belly as you crave one more. We will die heroes. We will die happy on your lips.
A love song to Lauren. You have give her my regards, by the way. I haven't seen her in a long time. Do another love song.
Okay. I promised you strange creatures, so let me give you one of those. So one fine day we were on the Cape, Cape Cod, that is, in Massachusetts, and I was there to do a reading later in the day, and naturally, I lost a contact lens. I was rather put out about this. And then, killing time, we went to this sad little aquarium. And guess who I am in this poem? Love song of the one-eyed fish. I circle the tank in the aquarium, waiting for the school groups to tumble down the aisle like acrobats escaping the circus, clowns on their day off. They chatter about all the sharks they want to see, the dolphins to feed. They stop at my tank on tiptoe, fingers streaking the glass, and then they scream at the hole in my face. I am the one-eyed fish. My eyeball scooped out of the socket by another fish in a fight over who would hide in the rusty cylinder at the bottom of the tank, the authentic recreation of my environment in the bay. The teachers scream at the school groups to stop screaming and say to each other, is that all? Is this it? We have no sharks or dolphins here, nothing on the second floor, only a can for donations by the door, and a one-eyed fish bumping off the glass. One morning, after I stare with my eye at the janitor mopping the floor, waiting for the seventh grade to yell in my half face, I see the flash of you, an angelfish in my tank, proof that the gods of the aquarium are benevolent, that they checked the rusty cylinder at the bottom of the tank and figured out why the other fish was always sleeping. I am a fish in a tank, doomed to swim in circles forever, and so I cannot hide the hole in my face. Yet you do not flit to the corner of the tank or dive into the rusty cylinder. You swim with me, and we circle the tank together. The school groups tumble down the aisle on cue, and the teacher says, "Look, an angelfish." If I could sing, that would be the name of my song. Look, an angelfish.
Martina Spada, 608-256-2001. Martina, I want to go back to, being that you mentioned having other friends, other teachers outside of the academy. You've written about many of them over the years, and I've always appreciated them. I want to go to Vladimir Morales, featured in Puerto Rican with the Bolshevik name.
Yes, so Vladimir Morales was a friend and activist in Amherst, Massachusetts. He was a member of the school committee. He was constantly up to something. And one day he cooked up the idea that he would like to raise the Puerto Rican flag on the town common. I thought that was a bit crazy, but I went along with it, and that turned out to be a tradition. We did that every year. Yet, for all that we engaged in various subversive activities together, it was something Vladimir did for me in an emergency, which was in fact a matter of life and death, that forever would endear him to me. So this is the poem I wrote as an elegy for Vladimir when he died in 2022. And it's called The Puerto Rican with the Bolshevik Name, for Vladimir Morales, 1951 to 2022. He shook my hand and said, "Vote for me." I knew him only from the lawn signs everywhere, the Puerto Rican with the Bolshevik name running for school committee. The last time, I didn't vote for him. I was too busy bellowing my poems in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, the land of cigarettes, where somebody said, "Are you a communist?" This time, I voted for him. One day he shook my hand and said, "Help me raise the Puerto Rican flag on the town common." I didn't help him raise the flag. I was too busy bellowing my poems at Newcastle, England, the land of coals, when a white-haired gentleman raised his hand and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but where is Puerto Rico?" E. Montgomery Riley knew. Harding's man, the island governor called King Monty, who never had to shake hands with a Puerto Rican and say, "Vote for me," said, "As long as Old Glory waves over the United States, it will wave over Puerto Rico." The only flag to raise is the flag confiscated by King Monty's chief of police. The only flag is the flag of rebels, caged like mice for experiments in electricity. In another century, another country, we raise the flag on the town common. Sometimes we struggle in the clatter of dead leaves, wrestling with the flag as it flapped up and down the pole, the editor of the neighborhood Puerto Rican paper aiming his camera at us to blur the poet and the politician. Once the rains came and I gave directions from the black wing of an umbrella as the Puerto Rican with the Bolshevik name hoisted the flag like a kite into the raindrops. "Looks great," I said. We scurried off for breakfast burritos. The raising of the flag, the flurry of petitions, the tally of votes at town meeting, the rallies on the common, the resolution against the Navy war games cratering the coral reef in Vieques, all dissolved away the day the Puerto Rican with the Bolshevik name slid behind the wheel and drove me to the emergency room, my hands gripping my belly, the morphine IV and the surgeon's knife waiting for me as he waited for me in the room with the TV stuck on Fox News and the snack machine guzzling quarters. Now, too late, I sign my name to his petition. I am not too busy anymore.
608-256-2001. We have a short time left. If you want to join us with a quick comment or observation, question. Martin, of course, as I was reading through Jailbreak of Sparrows, I found myself wondering what you're thinking about at this point, at this moment, with as I said in the introduction, this kind of stepped up attack coming from the right on, well, anything that isn't the dominant white narrative.
What? Yeah, well, we could do a whole hour on that, couldn't we? And I'm sure you have. You know, we're wrestling with language here. We're wrestling with the words that we need to articulate what is happening here. Sometimes I think we are too careful. We tiptoe around what's going on. We very carefully follow the lead of the mainstream media, and use terminology like authoritarianism. Well, he's an authoritarian. Or we use phrases like white nationalism. What's happening, of course, is we watch in astonishment, is that we are tilting into fascism. And that is a fascism infused with racism. If you want to call it authoritarianism, that's fine. If you want to call it white nationalism, okay, that's fine too. Some of this is new. Some of this, in fact, is not new at all. And, I am grateful to everyone who believes in the principles of this country, but it's important to remember this country has not always lived up to its principles, to put it mildly. And so we go on and on about the rule of law, but the rule of law has not always been the way we live our lives in the United States, to again put it mildly. It's at times like this, though, that I have to think of another dear and departed friend, Howard Zinn. And Howard would always find some example from history to remind us that the struggle goes on, that there is resistance, even if that resistance is now falling back, is that resistance is now in retreat. We have to keep in mind as we go through this chaos, this crisis, that progress is not linear. Social change is not linear. It zigs and it zags and it loops in figures of eight. We lose ground, we gain it back, we lose it again. This is not over.
Yeah, no, it's far, far from over. I noted last night on as I was watching the news, the news hour mentioned that Elon Musk is going to be leaving soon. And I couldn't help to think that part of it was his invitation to step aside some after the result of the election on Tuesday. He pumped millions and millions of dollars into the race for Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin, and Crawford, the Democrat, won. And it was billed, of course, nationwide as a gauge, a reading on where things could be. And of course, we're headed toward dark times in lots of ways. And how does the poet endure?
Well, the simple, or maybe simple-minded response would be to say the poet endures by writing poems. That's what we have to contribute. And of course, poets should be engaged. They should be writing engaged poetry. You've heard some of it this afternoon. They should be engaged in other ways, in all the ways that are meaningful, as people who are can act as advocates on behalf of those without an opportunity to be heard. Not that they couldn't get that chance, take up the advantage of that chance, given the chance they don't get it. Undocumented immigrants are by definition being silenced and dehumanized in this country. They don't have the platform to speak that so many of us do, and we have to take advantage of that, and we have to, it's a moral imperative to speak out. And if you're a poet, that's the language that you use. We now live in an age of mass deportation, but let's not forget that mass deportation requires mass collaboration, and we can refuse to collaborate.
608-256, just a couple minutes left here. Some final words, Martin. What are you working on these days? Any new projects?
This is it.
This is it.
When a book comes out, that's the project.
Uh-huh.
So that's basically it, you know, and raising a sheepu.
Raising, I'm sorry?
Yeah, exactly. A sheepu is a combination of a shih tzu and a toy poodle. We adopted him last fall, and he is 8 pounds of raw terror. 8 pounds of raw fury. And I had to trick him, get him out of the room so he wouldn't howl throughout the course of this interview. So I tossed a ball in the next room, and he followed it, and I closed the door behind him, and I feel bad about that.
Well, that should be your life, feeling bad about closing the door on your sheepu. Is that what you said it was?
That's a thing. It's a sheepu. I'm not making this up.
Okay.
She-dash-poo. And yes, that's the least of my problems.
Well, on that note, I'm going to have to say good day to you, good sir. And we'll be in touch, of course. And you've been listening to Martin Espada, acclaimed people's voice, former Madisonian and Mortista. Espada is referred to by some as the Pablo Neruda of North America. He was giving us samples from his newly released collection, Jailbreak of Sparrows. Check it out, folks. Check out any and all of Martin Espada. There's lots of his stuff online. He truly is a voice that, it should have ever wider audiences. Martin, my brother, thank you much for a great hour. I want to thank Jack for engineering. Sarah for producing. I want to thank you, our listeners, callers. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff, and I'll be speaking with you next week. Pre-recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. Yeah.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show, we're joined by labor historian Fred Glass for a conversation about general strikes, what they are, their history, their effectiveness, and why they are so difficult to pull off. Fred Glass was communications director for the California Federation of Teachers and instructor in labor and community studies at City College of San Francisco. He is the author of the book, From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement. And he's also a filmmaker, which we'll be showing this week in Berkeley. It's called We Mean to Make Things Over. It is a history of May Day. Fred Glass will join us, and we'll also take your phone calls and emails next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Stock markets worldwide have fallen sharply in response to Donald Trump's announcement of sweeping global trade tariffs. By one estimate, more than $1.5 trillion was wiped off the value of shares on Wall Street at the start of trading on Thursday. Shares in Europe and Asia were also down. From New York, Michelle Fleury reports.
Amongst the biggest losers on Wall Street are the US companies that investors think are most exposed to President Trump's New World Order for trade. Sportswear giant Nike may have seen its business model